Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602. Or toll-free across the United States, it's 1-877-753-3341. And now with today's topic, here is James White.
Things are just getting stranger and stranger and curiouser out there. That's all I can say. What we're going to do today, I can barely hear myself for some reason. What we're going to do today is if callers call in after we get at least, I don't know, half an hour's worth in at looking at the Wallace Irwin debate, then we'll cut that off and go to callers. If not, we'll just fill our time with that. But before we do that, there is a lot going on out there. Of course, the death of Mr. Breitbart was the big story as soon as I woke up this morning. I will confess, I only was marginally aware of the man. I do not spend time reading a lot of that kind of stuff. I knew who he was. I knew he was involved with Drudge and stuff like that. But that was the big story today, and I don't see a whole lot theological there. I might suggest some basic health issues that might be worth discussing at that point, but not going there. Instead, other than that, the big issue that a number of people have mentioned to me via Twitter and other means is, well, from one of the, from headlinenewsTV.com, one of many, 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 many sources. We read, the internet is filled with righteous indignation after reports that a Maryland woman was denied communion at her mother's funeral because she is a lesbian. Former Catholic school teacher Barbara Johnson says she wants the Reverend Marcel Guarnizo, who is presiding over the service, out of pastoral work after he publicly humiliated her in citing her homosexuality as a reason for denying her the sacrament, according to HLN affiliate WUSA. He put his hand over the body of Christ and looked at me and said, I can't give you communion because you live with a woman, and in the eyes of the church, that is a sin, she told the Washington Post. An online petition seeks a personal apology to Johnson from Cardinal Donald Wuerl, the Archbishop of Washington, D.C., and demands that he oust Guarnizo. In a statement obtained by HLN, the Archdiocese said its policy in determining communion qualifications is not to publicly reprimand anyone. And et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there is a picture associated with this particular article. Couple things. First, I do not believe that Marcel Guarnizo is a Christian priest, okay? I do not believe there is such thing as a priest in the New Testament outside of Jesus Christ. While every believer is a part of a kingdom of priests, the idea of the Roman priesthood, hey, I'm consistent here. I've debated this subject before, would debate it again in the future. There is no such thing as a priest according to the establishment of Jesus Christ and the order of his church found in the sacred scriptures themselves. And I think that the debate that we did with Mitchell Pacwa, I think, made that rather clear, to be perfectly honest with you. And so I do not believe that there is any man who has been ordained by the Roman Church who is an alter Christus, another Christ. I don't believe any man has the ability to call Christ down out of heaven and render him present upon the altar. And I believe that the Mass is something that, while I have attended one to observe it and learn, I don't think anyone should ever attend in any other context, because it is a blasphemy against the finished work of Jesus Christ. Are we clear on that? I actually am a Protestant, yes. That's what Protestants have believed in the past. Many are now very embarrassed by that, but I am not. I am significantly more concerned about what God thinks about the subject and the honor of the sacrifice of Christ than I am modern PC sensibilities. With that said, okay, with that said, I cannot believe for a second that any even semi-Orthodox or believing Roman Catholic could possibly support the punishing of this man for refusing to give to an open, practicing homosexual the Eucharist, for crying out loud. I mean, who do these people think they are? I mean, really, if you don't believe what the Roman Church teaches, then don't go to the Roman Church. Who do you think you... I mean, these people really believe they have Uber rights. They have more rights than anybody else. They are better than we are. They can demand what no one else could possibly demand. It's a part of, I think, the warping that takes place in the mind of the homosexual. It's a part of the twistedness. You know what Rome teaches on the subject. Yes, Rome may be inconsistent. I mean, there's lots of homosexuals running around in priest habits. Okay? That's a problem. But you know what Rome teaches. And according to other reports I read, she showed up with her homosexual lover. I mean, it wasn't like this was a rumor, for crying out loud. She showed up with her significant other, quote unquote, whatever that's supposed to mean. So, what do you expect this guy to do? And as strongly as I oppose Roman Catholicism, and no one can question my credentials as an opponent of Roman Catholicism, and it's false gospel and all that, stuff. The only thing that could make me could lower it in my perspective was if they gave in on something like this and said, "Oh, we're sorry." I mean, is there anybody in the world left with a backbone? You've got people running around. You've got Muslims running around murdering other Muslims because of the burning of corrupted Korans in Afghanistan. So they run around and murder fellow Muslims. And you have politicians in the United States stumbling over themselves to go, "We're sorry, so sorry." I just want to go, would somebody grow a backbone somewhere? It's just amazing to me. I read stuff like this and go, has the world gone completely insane? It's just absolutely amazing to me. Sorry. Deep breath, calm. Relax, drink some Propel Fitness water, do something. I don't know. I mean, you know, I don't know how much more clearly I could have expressed myself. I fully disagree with the Roman priesthood. I have written on the subject, I've debated on the subject. But man, if you're going to claim to be that, and if Rome's going to claim, we are the infallible church, well, then don't grovel to these people, for crying out loud. That's the only thing that could put you even lower in my eyes, is if you don't, is to teach falsehood, and don't even have the guts to stand up for it. I mean, I can respect a believing Roman Catholic. I don't get these liberal Roman Catholics. What's that all about? You know, Nancy Pelosi running around, you know, "I'm a Catholic. I stand for everything the church doesn't, but I'm a Catholic." What is this? And I just like to say to every Roman Catholic listening, excuse me, you want to be taken seriously? You want Rome to be taken seriously? When they start kicking these people out, then you will at least be able to say that Rome takes her teachings seriously. But as long as these politicians are allowed to promote abortion and homosexuality, and then go and be a good Catholic and get their sacraments, stuff like that. Folks, how can we take you seriously? I mean, really, honestly. It's just, I I know what would happen to those folks if they're a member of my church, because we actually do believe what we say that we believe. So, anyway, I feel much better now. just lost all of the listeners, but I feel much better now. So actually, the graph probably doesn't show any problems there at all. But yeah, anyways. All right. And LaShawn just came in channel two, so she'll be tweeting about this. And see, I get to say the things the way that LaShawn doesn't get to say it because, you know, I'm, you know, anyway. All right, let's get to the Wallace Irwin debate. By the way, I just finished recording parts 4 and 5 of my response to Sam Gipp. So that's it for this one. I mean, his video is only 8 minutes long. I did five responses that were about, what, I don't know, an hour and 15 minutes or something like that. So at least, maybe more than that, I don't know. But I just finished the last part of my response to that first video, because you can tell there's going to be more. And, hey, I said from the start, good quality. Audio, not so much. Video, very good quality. Shot well. Give him props. Did a good job. Did a good job. No two ways about it. The problem is, it's full of abject falsehoods. That's just all there is to it. So we've got 5 of them. The first 3 have been posted. I will post the next 2 on Twitter tonight, and then I will post them over the next couple days on the blog, especially since I will be headed to Hawaii, Hilo, Hawaii, starting on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. I'll be speaking in Hilo, Hawaii, and then Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in Honolulu. And so I'll be over there, and that means I don't know what we're going to do about the dividing line. We might be able to work something out during the days. It's possible. I think they're 1 or 2 hours behind California. Two hours behind California. It could be 3 behind us. So we'll see. We'll see what works out. We'll try to figure that out and see if we can't work something in. Especially if, you know, some major thing happens, you know, Sam Gipp posts some video. Because I couldn't, does anyone remember me playing, or did I just mention on the air? Because I can't find the sound file, and maybe if someone can find it, someone had tweeted it to me, and maybe if someone in the Twitter audience. But someone, I believe, tweeted to me, and I downloaded and listened to, but now I can't find the file, a recent sermon by Sam Gipp where he mentioned me. And do you remember me playing where, okay, so I must have just mentioned it. Toward the end of the sermon, he mentions my name, and he says, James White's so stupid, he shouldn't be allowed to use sharp implements while eating. You don't remember that one? Yeah, I guess I thought I'd played that. I guess I didn't. I remember listening to it in my kitchen, so I downloaded it from from some source. But maybe somebody on Twitter will remember, and they'll retweet me that particular URL.
Never heard that before.
Really?
Nope.
Okay, then I didn't do it on the dividing line.
And it's ironic that you were listening to that particular kind of comment in your kitchen.
That's true, because yeah. there were numerous sharp implements nearby, which he would probably feel I should not be allowed to have access to. He mentioned me twice right toward the end of a sermon, and one of the lines was that James White is so stupid that he should not be allowed to use sharp implements while eating. And so I just...
Given how the Ankerberg exchange turned out, and
which is on YouTube, I know.
Yeah, having watched that a few times myself, I don't think he should be making statements like that, because that's pretty reflective.
Well, I obviously
you hear that?
Look. Sam is a caricature of Sam. I mean, Sam does not realize just how useful he is in illustrating the mindset of King James Onlyus. He really doesn't. So he just, you know, we played some of his comments recently in regards to Calvinism, and you can imagine what is... Yeehaw. Anyways, let's get back to the Wallace Irwin debate. And like I said, up to you how long we go here. I've already gone 14 minutes, but... If I see the phone lines filling up and you've got some comments you want to make, then we'll try to sort of back time, leave enough room toward the end of the program to get you in. And if not, then we can, believe me, we're only, why does that say 109? Well, we're only about 20 some odd minutes into the Wallace Irwin debate, so we've got plenty to do there. So 877-753-3241 if you want to get in. Just a reminder, this is the October 1st debate. This is not the most recent one. I understand it is, you know, I have that one. I've listened to that one, too. We'll get to it when we can. But I've played you the portion where Dan made the announcement about the manuscript finds and the Brill book. Brill is a high-end academic publisher. Anything that comes from Brill is incredibly expensive. And the fact that he's one of the editors of the book that's coming out that announces these manuscript finds, so this is very important. But we already played those. But going back to the opening statement by Bart Ehrman is where we are. It's been a while, so here we go.
Several examples of ones that strike me as rather significant. Changes where a scribe will... it looks like he's intentionally changing something. Now, we don't have the scribes around to interview, so we don't know that they intentionally changed. I mean, we can't ask them, did you do this on purpose or not? But you're going to see from these examples, it looks like somebody's doing this on purpose.
Now, of course, hopefully you're aware of the fact that Bart Ehrman's really his primary claim to fame in the scholarly realm, I'll be perfectly honest with you, is... his 1994, as I recall, I didn't bring it in with me, work where he specifically focuses upon what he concludes are the theologically motivated textual variants of the New Testament. And it's a scholarly tome. There are reasons to question some of its conclusions and things like that, but... that's really one of his major strong areas, is he has certainly written in that particular area. But I appreciate the fact that he admits that, well, you know, we can theorize about this, but we can't really know. Keep that in mind, because a lot of people quote his stuff as if you can make that conclusion.
If not, it's just a massive accident. But they still are important changes. And so we'll look at those. Before, I just want to make one final point, that the earliest scribes were much worse than the later scribes. They certainly made a lot more accidental changes. They may have made a lot more intentional changes. And there's no way for us to know.
I thoroughly disagree. Once again, to say there's no way for us to know is to conclude that having multiple lines of transmission coming out of the primitive period that are clearly not genetically directly related and yet communicate the same text utterly undermines Bart Ehrman's primary theory that there has been this massive kind of uncontrolled change to the text in the primitive period. In other words, given how what we have in those earliest manuscripts coming from different sources, different places, different lines of transmission, when it comes into history, we see the New Testament, well, as we have it today. If to fulfill the kind of conspiracy theory that Bart Ehrman is making money off of, and there were New Testaments that read very differently than what we have today, where's the evidence of their existence? Where's the evidence of their existence? See, most of the time in these debates, he gets away with demanding that we provide the positive evidence. We provide the photocopies of the originals. He has to explain why our manuscript tradition is as united as it is. I mean, what we've discovered is that when he talks about the earliest obtainable text, that he figures we pretty have much determined that. We are just playing games. We are just, arguing about a jot or a tittle. But it's before that time period that he's positing this period of just massive alteration. Where is the evidence of these other readings, these massively altered New Testaments? There isn't any. There isn't any. And he needs to be challenged on that.
Let me tell you about some of the intentional changes. I'll just give you a list of ones that these will be passages that if you know your Bibles well, which I have a strange feeling you do, unlike my students at Chapel Hill, these will be passages that you probably know about.
Now it's interesting. I will. You got to remember this most recent debate, not this one, the one that took place just a few weeks ago. Took place at Chapel Hill. And in all of his other debates, he constantly rips on his students. But he had to just slightly alter his favorite jokes so as to not be lynched or pied on his own campus. that was funny.
In the King James Bible, 1 John chapter 5, verses 7 and 8,
I am absolutely amazed. I will just be honest with you. Every single time Bart Ehrman talks about the Kami Yohannium, I just shake my head. I bet, I could be wrong, but I bet if we go to his scholarly writings, we go to his published articles, I have the Brill compilation of most of all of his early published article stuff. You know, another one of those $169 books. I imagine there's no discussion whatsoever of the Kami Yohannium. Because amongst textually knowledgeable individuals, it's not an issue. It's not an issue. He knows that a Greek reading that has nothing earlier than the 14th century to commend it to us textually, was not a part of the original text of the New Testament. He knows that. So bringing it up in this context, to me, just always leaves me shaking my head. Why is there such a... I'm sorry. Anyway.
Provides us with the only place in the entire New Testament where the doctrine of the Trinity is explicitly taught. The doctrine of the Trinity is that there are three persons in the Godhead, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and those are not three gods, the three are one. 1 John chapter 5, verses 7 and 8, in the King James Bible, refers to there are three in heaven, the Father, the Word, and the Spirit, and these three are one. That's in the King James Bible, but it's not in the Greek manuscript. You get it, it's actually in a few Greek manuscripts, and it's in Latin manuscripts, which was at the heart of the Latin Vulgate. It's an important verse because, as I said, you can intuit or you can reason towards the Trinity from other passages in the New Testament. This is the only passage that explicitly teaches it, and it wasn't originally in the New Testament.
Again, information utterly so basic and so far removed from any serious Trinitarian discussions, church history discussions, textual critical discussions, that I can only conclude that Bart Ehrman includes it in there for shock value for the ignorant in the audience. I guess just like King James Onlyus for the opposite reason, and of course our Muslim friends who constantly bang away on this despite its utter irrelevance to their case.
Dan and I do not disagree on this point.
Nope.
This verse was not originally in the New Testament. Is it an important verse? Well, it was for my grandfather. When the Revised Standard Version came out in 1952, he went through the roof because it didn't have the teaching of the Trinity. They took out the Trinity.
Well, that demonstrates that Bart's grandfather was just as ignorant as a lot of the Muslims who criticize the Bible on that level. And there's a lot of Christians. I understand there's ignorance, but I thought this was, I thought this was a scholarly context and a scholarly discussion.
This was a huge offense. Not nearly as offensive as I would be to him, but it was a...
Yeah, he certainly recognizes that where he's ended up would make his grandfather spin in his grave. Definitely that's he doth speak the truth at this point.
It was a huge offense. Well, it's a rather important matter whether this verse is in there or not.
But it's not a disputed issue. So I just don't know why it shows up here.
Is Jesus ever called the unique God in the New Testament? It depends which manuscript you trust for John chapter 1, verse 18.
Now, this is, we're getting into the normal Bart Ehrman presentation. And what he wants to do is he wants to raise, sometimes, as in this case, serious textual critical variants primarily. And do so in the context of making it sound like, well, it's all up to you. You sort of have to, make up your own mind and no one really knows who really knows? That's what he wants to try to communicate. And the reality is there is a textual variant here. There's no question. It's a very, very important textual variant. It's one that we have discussed many, many times before. And yet, instead of saying, here's an important textual variant, here's the information, here's why modern translations have gone the direction they've gone, et cetera, it's, well, it all depends on which manuscripts you trust. He doesn't believe that. He doesn't believe that. He doesn't think that it's just a personal matter or just a matter of choosing which manuscripts you trust. He doesn't go there. That's not how he does textual criticism. So why present it in this way? I think very clearly it is a matter of creating in the minds of his hearers a particular kind of understanding that may or may not have any connection to the truth. And, of course, we're talking about John 1:18, in case you're wondering. And when you look at John chapter 1, verse 18, you know that monogenes theos, unique God, he's written extensively on this. I just don't know why he would do this, other than what I've just mentioned. But he knows what the textual evidence is. And he knows that he's written entire articles on this subject. And so it almost seems like someone playing coy, and I don't like coy. We had someone recently come into, it was somebody in Twitter. A couple nights ago, some of you may have seen me having a conversation with somebody on Twitter. And let me just tell everybody, because sometimes people come in. In fact, we had a guy come into the chat channel this morning. And I felt sort of bad. It used the nick B-O-E-T. I think it was B-O-E-T. And I looked down, and I've got a PM indicator. So I've been sent a private message. I opened it up. This guy sent me a book. I mean, pages and pages of stuff. I was sort of surprised our system even allowed that to happen, to be very honest with you. And so I just sort of said in channel, I don't accept PMs from people I don't know, because I don't. We can chat in channel, because a lot of people want to come in the chat channel and go, I'd like to ask Dr. White some questions. And all of a sudden, they feel like I'm a terrible, horrible person if I don't stop everything I'm doing and just chat with them about whatever they want to chat about. That's not why I'm there. I'm not the online Bible answer man. We have at least 2 hours a week normally, sometimes more, where I'm here. Phone lines are open right now. And there's plenty of ways to contact me. That's not the way to do it. Anyways, I felt badly because I just sort of had to explain to the guy, that's not how you do it. And I was already aware of that. And he went and left thinking that I was mad at him, and I wasn't. And I sort of felt badly about that. But back to the point, if you come into our chat channel and you want to argue, we have a simple rule. You tell us where you're coming from. You tell us what church you're a part of. Tell us what your spiritual background is. because it is worthless to have a conversation with somebody when they won't tell you where they're coming from. It's a waste of time. If at least I know where you're coming from, then I can put a context to your words and we might be able to communicate. Well, there's this guy on Twitter a couple nights ago, and he just couldn't get the message. He was angry with me because I had made some comments about the pastor in Iran and I had made some comments about oneness teaching and stuff like that. And he's telling me, well, what church do you go to? I'm a radical apostolic Christian monotheist. And on the one hand, he says Jesus is the I am. On the other hand, he doesn't believe he preexisted. And I'm like, what? I mean, you could not even make heads or tails out of what this guy was saying. It was complete gobbledygook. And every time I kept saying, would you at least tell me what church you go to? I can go look at the statement of faith. I can have some hey, if you're defending your faith, you don't need to know anything about mine. No, that's not true. Because your questions assume certain backgrounds that I may not know. So you have to be upfront and honest and answer that question. It's just necessary.
Imagine the criticism you would get if you hid from the public church you went to. You're
right.
Just out there throwing it out.
Yeah.
You know? And this is Bible doctrine, so take it because I said it.
Right. Yeah, no, I can't expect it of others, and I'm certainly not going to expect it in that context, and especially in a written context, in Twitter, in the chat channel, by email. The only way to make heads or tails is to be open about where you're coming from. It's just absolutely necessary. I'm not sure how I got there, but just something I wanted to mention.
Some of our manuscripts, the manuscripts that some textual scholars prefer and others don't prefer, some in this verse talk about Jesus as the unique God. Nope.
Some textual scholars prefer. In other words, the vast majority, and in fact, interestingly enough, Bart Ehrman will at one point say, well, critical scholars, which means all scholars who agree with him. Well, when it comes to this issue, the vast majority of the people that he himself insists we need to listen to would agree that P66 and P75 and Sinaiticus and Vaticanus are really, really important. And there are some, you know, Byzantine priority folks, but they represent a very small minority. So it just seems like, you know, Bart changes his tune depending on who he's talking to and what he's trying to accomplish.
No one has seen the Father at any time. The unique Son or the unique God who is in the bosom of the Father, that one has made him known. Is Jesus actually the unique God himself? Or is he the Son of God? Both are important, but I mean, it does matter whether Jesus is called God, the God, in the New Testament. Depends what you do with John chapter 1, verse 18.
You know, I was looking, the newer editions of Accordance have this thing called New Testament Textual Interlinear. And I've set it up on my computer here in the Dividing Line Studios. And I've got Tischendorf, the TR, Westcott Hort, Byzantine, and Sinaiticus and Vaticanus. And they're supposed to give me the readings of each one of these. And I just realized there's clearly a problem with these. Because it lists for both the TR and the Byzantine the reading of Theon. Monogenes Theon. And that is not the reading of the TR nor of the Byzantine manuscript tradition. I think I need to let the folks at Accordance know that. I'm glad I didn't. I'm glad I looked at that. That's very, very, very interesting. I will go to a different tab that I have that has the more accurate information. See, it's good to be able to check things out.
Does the Gospel of Luke teach a doctrine of atonement?
Now, this one's interesting. Especially given the fact that where Ehrman's coming from, asking the question seems a little unfair to me because I don't think he thinks that Luke or Paul or John or anybody else is consistent enough within even their own books, their own writings, to determine what their quote-unquote theology is in the first place. So I think it's a little unfair. Because his system really wouldn't allow him to answer that in a meaningful fashion, even if there wasn't a textual variant there.
The doctrine of atonement is that Christ's death for sins. Luke, interestingly, changes a number of verses that he found in his predecessor, the Gospel of Mark, which talked about Jesus as an atonement for sins. Okay, so this is a little bit complicated, but everybody, most Bible scholars, I think most Bible scholars agree that Mark was the first gospel written and that Luke copied Mark for some of his stories. And he got stories from other sources.
Which is one of the main reasons I don't just simply bow down to current consensus and Mark and priority theories and stuff like that. And it's difficult, I realize, for theological students to see the reasons why right now. But just remember that if you were in the cutting edge of theological education 140 years ago, you would have thought that John was written 170 A.D. There's a lot of things that you would have accepted just because that's what everybody accepted and that nobody accepts it today. And so just keep that in mind. I realize that there's this pressure to fit in and to all the rest of that stuff. I think it's far more important to take the bigger view than the short-range view, which unfortunately Christian scholarship frequently takes the short-range view.
One of the verses in Mark is a very famous verse from Mark chapter 10. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. This is a verse that Luke excluded when he gave his account of Jesus' life. He doesn't include that verse for whatever reason. It is striking that the only place where Luke's ideas about Jesus' death indicate that his death was an atonement for sins is in the passage Luke 22, verses 19 and 20, where Jesus is at the Last Supper. Jesus, in Luke's Gospel, Jesus first gives the cup before he gives the bread. This is the cup of the new covenant, etc. Then he gives the bread. This is my body broken. And then, in some manuscripts, it doesn't just say, this is my body that's been broken. It says, this is my body that has been broken for you. And then it goes on to say, this cup is the covenant of my blood, which is shed for you. The death of Jesus for the sake of others, which is otherwise missing in Luke. And you say, well, so what if it's missing in Luke? It's in Matthew. Okay, but does it matter what Luke says or not? You say, no, it doesn't matter. It just matters what Matthew says. Really? Luke doesn't have a doctrine of atonement depending on which manuscript you trust for chapter 22.
Now, here's one of the problems I have with this. Ehrman seems to think that the Gospels existed in a vacuum. Well, okay, not so much vacuum, given that he says that Luke was using Mark and just sort of editing him for the fun of it. But he doesn't seem to recognize that the Gospels, as they were written, were intended for use in the church, and that part and parcel of the worship of the church was the recitation, the retelling of the stories of the ministry of Jesus himself. And so the gospel writers would not think, well, this is all someone's going to have, because if you are part of the Christian community, that's not the case. So it wasn't that Luke is sitting there going, well, if I don't include this, then someone may never know about it, and I don't, then someone may never know. No, that's not a part of the context at all. It's similar to the objections that I hear from my Muslim friends against Paul. Well, Paul never talks about the historical Jesus, and Paul really didn't believe that Jesus existed historically, because he doesn't talk about the virgin birth, and he doesn't talk about the story of Jesus. you really think that every book, every epistle he wrote, he had to repeat the entire gospel story over and over and over and over and over again, when he already knew that the whole reason that church existed was because the stories of Jesus were already part and parcel of what they possessed? It was a part of their regular, every Lord's Day recitations? And especially when we talk about this, I mean, there's a very interesting and important set of variants in Luke chapter 22, verses 17 through 20. And they need to be examined on the basis of the manuscripts in which they're found. And the problem I have with Ehrman and with many of the modern textual critics is that because they have abandoned a belief that we can obtain the original text, and because they have decided that they somehow have the ability to read minds, they are starting to do their textual criticism based upon these external theories that assume certain things about the text of Scripture, rather than just simply trying to identify the earliest text of Scripture that we have in the manuscripts. And the result is, I think, a bit of a mess. Would Luke have for a second thought, given that he's in the Christian community, given that he's the compatriot of Paul, and that Paul's letters have this clear testimony? Oh, I forgot. He doesn't believe he was a compatriot of Paul. So see, you can't really do this. You see, that's why these questions don't come up to believing Christians. That's why they're so befuddled by Ehrman's approach, because you're going, well, Luke was with Paul, and Paul had a very advanced doctrine of atonement in 1 Corinthians 11. You've got the whole Lord's Supper thing. That's even before the Gospels. And so I don't understand. But then you got to remember, yeah, but you see, Ehrman doesn't think that Luke wrote Luke, and that Luke was ever with Paul, and therefore, because he thinks Acts is just made up. And oh, I see. So you start with the assumption that all this stuff is a mess, and it's untrue, and it's inconsistent. And then once you've deconstructed it and pulled it apart and said it's contradictory here, contradictory there, oh, then you can use that to make this type of an argument. Ah, see, that's how it works. That's where it goes. And that's what's going on here.
The favorite story of many Bible readers of Jesus is the story of Jesus and the woman taken in adultery. Jesus is teaching in the temple. Y'all know the story. It's in all the Jesus movies. This story is so good, you can't leave it out of a Jesus movie. When Mel Gibson made The Passion of the Christ, even though it was about Jesus' last hours, he had to include this story, so he included it as a flashback. Right? Jesus was remembering this happened, because you can't make a Jesus movie without the woman taken in adultery. Let the one without sin among you be the first to cast a stone at her. It's found in manuscripts of the Gospel of John, but it's not originally in the Gospel of John, probably, because it's not in the earliest manuscripts of John. It's a story that was added later, after our earliest manuscripts. How many stories were added before our earliest manuscripts?
Now, we'll close with this one and then start taking our phone calls. We have one right now. We can take some more. But this is really interesting. This is very, very good. This is not the best example for Bart Ehrman to use, because other textual critical scholars, some of whom he evidently somewhat, I think, arrogantly dismisses, people like Kurt Ahlund, have pointed out that when you have a disruption in the transmission of the text, it leaves evidence. He has to reject that. He has to ignore that. That's Ehrman, has to ignore that. Because you see, John 7:53-8:11 appears for the first time 500 years after the birth of Christ. And it appears in Codex Bezae-Cantabrigiensis. And Codex Bezae-Cantabrigiensis is the least reliable New Testament manuscript that we have from that time period. And so he keeps talking about these early, this is half a millennium in. And what he didn't mention is in certain manuscripts, Family 1 and Family 13, it's found in Luke. Yeah. Luke. After Luke 21:25 in certain manuscripts, and after Luke 21:38 in certain manuscripts, and in manuscript 13:33, it is found after Luke 24:53. So if you have a story that doesn't appear for the first 500 years, the textual history of the New Testament, and when it does appear, it appears in different books, John or Luke, then that's really strong evidence that it's not original. What evidence does Dr. Ehrman have about that time period? And as we find earlier and earlier manuscripts, this time period is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. But let's say the first 100 years of the transmission of the New Testament text. He wants us to think, hey, if it happened 500 years afterwards, it might have happened a lot during that first 100 years, right? Where is the evidence? In other words, if that happened, think about it. Since you have multiple lines of transmission, then you're going to find, let's come up with a story. Cursing the fig tree. This came up with a story off the top of my head. Cursing the fig tree. The fig tree. Yeah, the fig tree. Let's say that that is one of these stories that just pops in, that it wasn't original, it's added in later. Since we have multiple lines of transmission, what that would mean is that we would find copies of the Gospels that have it and that don't have it. And we'd find them concurrently. In other words, we'd find from around the year 200, let's say we'd find P66 has it and P75 doesn't. Is that what we find? No. No. That's not what we find. So you see, he has to dismiss the reality of the multiple lines of transmission. He's got to dismiss it for it to, for his theory to work. And John 7:53-8:11 is an excellent example of that, because we can recognize it's a variant. We have entire complete copies of the Gospel of John that long predate Codex Vesey Canterburgiensis. And it's not there. And so that's a very, very important point to keep in mind. All right, 877-753-3341 is the phone number that you can call to be getting involved with stuff here on the program. We've got about 11 minutes left. Let's talk with Mike. Hi, Mike.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I'm kind of somewhat new to the whole Calvinism debate, so I downloaded some of yours, and I've been listening to them. And I had a question that really kind of threw me. I mean, I've been following it pretty well up until I heard this question. In the Bible Answer Man debate, the Read My Book debate,
yes.
You asked your opponent, you said, how does God know what a libertarian free creature is going to do in time? And then based on the conversation that followed, it seems like your position is that not only is that an unbiblical view, but it's also somehow a logically impossible view?
I'm not sure what you're saying. I didn't understand what you're saying. God does know. I clearly defended that for a couple hours there, so I'm not sure what you're asking.
Well, you were trying to save your opponent by asking the question that it doesn't make sense that you know, your question, how does God know what a libertarian free creature is going to do in time?
Right, because he doesn't believe that there is a divine decree that determines the events in time. And so while he was affirming, he denied he was an open theist. So he was affirming that God does know future events. I was asking him, how does God know future events? I wanted him to take a stand. Does he hold to simple foreknowledge? How does God have knowledge of what a free creature is going to do? Is he a Molinist? Does he believe in middle knowledge? Where does he stand? And George isn't really theologically trained and really astute in those areas. And so during the breaks, it was interesting. There was one person on staff there that was throwing out Molinism and middle knowledge and all the rest of that stuff. But I don't think that's where George wants to go, or just doesn't understand what Molinism is or how it works or something along those lines. But I was saying, how does God know? I say God knows because God decreed events in time. And we discussed that a good bit. We went through Genesis 50:20, and we went through Isaiah chapter 10 and Acts chapter 4, each instances where the sinful actions of man are said to have been a part of the predestined purpose of God, their intentions in those actions evil, God's intentions good, pure, and holy. Does that...
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I tried to really separate the issue between... Well, let me just say this. I mean, his response to your question was that God knows everything because by nature he is all-knowing.
Yeah.
He responded, but how?
Right.
And so, I mean, it seems to me like you feel, you know, not only that the Bible doesn't support his view, but that it's somehow, you know, logically impossible, but that you
can't
have...
It's not an answer to the question. He just says, well, he just knows by nature. And I go, how does he know by nature? Can you answer the question? What comes first in God's knowledge? When God chose to create the universe, did he know what was going to happen as a result of his creation? Well, I think George would say, yes. Okay, there's two ways that he could know that. Either he knows that because what takes place is the result of his sovereign decree being worked out in time, or God passively takes in knowledge. He says, okay, I'm going to create, and so there's this point in time where he goes, I'm going to make these decisions. Well, there's the results, and so I take in knowledge of what's going to happen as a result. And so God tosses the cosmic dice, and he wins and goes, yay, worship me. Does God take in knowledge in that way? Was there a time he didn't know? And if it's not the result of his sovereign decree, then what's it the result of? Is it the result of free creatures, cosmic forces, a combination of all of the above? And how can he guarantee what the future is going to be? And how could he know that he was going to be glorified in all that he took place when he created, if the end result actually is just the combination of all these sub-forces coming together to create the fabric of time?
Yeah, no, and again, I'm new on this debate, but, I mean, what you just said there just jumps out at me as a false dichotomy, that those are the only two options.
What's
and
the
I
other mean, option? Kind
of, well, wouldn't the other option be that he would know that he created, so it's not, you know, like you said in the debate, you said, you know, God just simply creates and goes, oh, look, I won at the end. Like, there would be a creation, and then after that, he would say, oh, you know, I just happened to win.
Right.
But how come he couldn't create everything in a way to where everybody's free will would have played out in a way that he would have won? So he would have known right from the get-go.
How does that work? So in other words, he creates so that everyone, so you're a Molinist, you believe in middle knowledge.
I think so, yeah.
Well, the problem with that is, if you want to try to keep man as a autonomous creature, who there is no sovereign decree, God is not working all things according to the purpose of his will, Ephesians 1:11, God does not do what he wants in heaven and earth, Psalm 135:6. If you want to get rid of all those biblical passages where God specifically says, I'm doing all this, and I'm doing it to my own ends, and you want man to be the one that determines all these things, but you still want to have an end result where God sort of still accomplishes something, then you have to fall into this middle knowledge idea where God looks at all the possible ways, all the possible universes out there. And he has this special knowledge, we don't know where it comes from, of knowing what every person would do given any situation that they're put in. Now, how he could know what a person would do before he actually decrees to create that person and form them in a certain way, I have no earthly idea, but the Molinists don't either, but that's another issue we can get into. I think it undercuts the entire system, but anyway.
I guess that is right from the get-go from my call. I guess that is what I'm getting at. So based on what you just said there, you're saying that, you know, not only is this unbiblical, but it's somehow impossible
yes.
for an all-powerful, all-knowing God to know what free-willed people are going to do before he created them. I don't see, that doesn't make any sense. How
okay.
would that be impossible?
I think it's pretty simple. Why do I do the things I do? Because of the way I was made. And God made me the way that I am. So the only way you can know what I'm going to do in the future is for me to exist. And middle knowledge says God knows that before he created me in any particular way at all. And so it makes someone other than God responsible for the form of creation. And in fact, in Molinism, God could not, for example, create a world where he saves everybody. He ran all the possible worlds, and this is the best he could do. That's what you're left with in Molinism. But if you want to know why it's impossible, it's because it assumes that God has a knowledge, but it does not give a grounding for how God could have that knowledge. Because what I do as a creature flows from my created nature. Well, who determined my created nature? God did. So how can you leave out God's decree to create me in a certain way? You got to leave it to go. You got to leave the decree out because that messes everything up. Leave that out. So now somehow, how can God have knowledge of what I will do when God has not decreed who I will be?
I guess I don't see the problem there. I mean, I guess I feel, well, I don't know who exactly would have the burden of proof, but I mean, from where I'm standing, it just seems like if you're going to say that God can't do that, you need to somehow show how it's impossible for an all-powerful, all-knowing God, that it's impossible for him to be able to create a free being and know what he's going to do in the future. I mean, I guess as humans, it may be hard for us to, because I don't know what other people are going to do in the future, but I don't see how that somehow denies God's power to do that.
Well, Mike, the fact of the matter is the Bible contradicts your position. The Bible specifically says God has a divine decree, and it determines what men will do. So this is a philosophical discussion. It's not a biblical one. The biblical position is God created us, and God created the fabric of time, and men act according to the decree of God. That's just, you can't read Proverbs and Psalms and Isaiah and Acts and Genesis, and you can't read those without recognizing that's the case. I mean, that's just the plain teaching of Scripture. And so I would start there, and I did on the program, but then I'm demonstrating that when people say, well, those can be interpreted in other ways, and you know, you still got this thing called free will, which, of course, is never ascribed to man in the Scriptures anywhere. It's an unbiblical term. It's a philosophical term that's imported into Scripture. And I'm simply saying that if you're going to say that God creates a bunch of autonomous creatures, well, either we are autonomous, and therefore, well, let me ask you, does God know what you're going to have for dinner tonight?
Yes.
Can you have anything else?
Well, so, I mean, I think that's kind of a sneaky question. I mean, I'd say no, I can't, but I did have the free will to make that. I mean, it's not that he forced my hand.
Okay, but his foreknowledge, can God's foreknowledge be invalidated and proved false?
No.
Okay, then God knows exactly what's going to happen in the future, and you cannot do other than that, can you?
Yes, but that still doesn't leave out the option that, I mean, I still can choose. He just knew what
can
I was going to choose.
Just knew it. So if he looked down the, so did he know from eternity what you're going to eat for dinner?
Yes.
So he knew all free will choices that led to your birth and led to where you live and all that. He knows all of that, not because he decreed it, but because he just looked down the corridors of time, right?
Well, yeah. The way you asked that question,
So there was a time when God learned what the result of his creation was, right?
No. You just said through all time. So there wasn't a time where he, like you say, kind of...
Have you eaten dinner yet?
No.
Okay. So when he created, you hadn't eaten dinner yet. It wasn't a reality. So there was a time... Logically, did God choose to create... Or is creation eternal?
He chose to create.
Okay, so there was a time before creation. So when he chose to create, if there wasn't a decree, and the end result is merely what free men do, then there was a time when he took in knowledge of what the result of his creation would be. Yes?
Well, how come he couldn't have just always known that throughout time? Why is that not a possibility?
Because that makes creation eternal, and it makes us and our actions eternal.
Well, why couldn't he have known before he created
Mike, the point is, Mike, the point is that that knowledge either comes from God or it comes from you. What? You are saying it comes from what you do rather than God's decree. And I say that would make it absolutely impossible for God to be able to say, for example, that at such and such a time, I am going to accomplish this, if the ultimate authority is the autonomous will of man. I mean, the only logical conclusion to your situation is that God could have called the Apostle Paul, and Paul could have said, nah, not interested, I'm free. I'm free.
Well, because he would have known that he would have said that, so he wouldn't have called on him.
Which means how is that an autonomous will, then? It's not an autonomous will. It's already known, and means when God created, there would be no way for him to determine the outcome of those things. How does God's sovereign decree? Well, do you even believe in a sovereign decree? Do you believe when God says he works all things after the counsel of his will, Ephesians 1:11?
Yeah, absolutely. I know it seems like I'm calling just to, like, fight with you. I'm honestly, you probably don't believe me, but, like, I mean, honestly, I'm open-minded. I'm looking into this stuff. I mean, I'm just trying to
test
your beliefs here. But a question I asked, I got cut off in the middle. I mean, to what you were saying about my dinner, do you think that it's impossible for God to know before he created the universe what I was going to have for dinner today?
No, I believe that the biblical teaching is the reason God knows what you're going to have for dinner today is that he has decreed the fabric of time, not that he created something that was outside of his creative control as far as its essence. And then as it spun into existence, at that point in time, he takes in knowledge of what's going to happen. I see absolutely no evidence of that whatsoever.
Why does there have to be a point in time where he learned what I was going to have for dinner? Why? How come
because,
he couldn't have known that?
Because
from
you
the beginning
agreed.
All time?
Because you agreed that there is a time before God chose to create.
Yes.
Okay. How could God know before he chose to create what was going to happen in his creation? Before he chose to create.
Excellent point. I mean, that question shows this is an excellent point. I think I don't see any reason why God can't know what I'm going to have for dinner tonight before he created universe. Why can't he have known that? He's all
powerful. So even before he chooses to create.
Well, no, not chooses to create.
That's what I said.
Okay,
before God chose to create.
He created. Well, why does he have to choose all of a sudden, like he changed his mind? I mean, why couldn't he just, from eternity past, he always knew he was going to create, and then he just did it at one point. I guess point in time probably wouldn't even be an accurate way to put it. He created time when he created the universe. That's probably not even accurate. But why would you, I mean, I don't see this impossibility that under my view, God all of a sudden learned what I was going to have for dinner. He could have just always known that.
Because that makes your actions not only eternal, but determinative to God's actions. And until God chose to create you and formed you and gave you the desires that you have, there would be no way that a universal Mike could be known as to what his actions were going to be and as to what his desires would be as to know what your dinner was going to be this evening in the first place. There is no universal Mike. The reason you like what you like is because God made you that way. And so before there is a decree to make you, there would be no basis upon having this, what's called middle knowledge, of what Mike would do in any given situation. There's no basis for that. And in fact, that's why if you'll take the time to study the Molinists who promote this, what they say is there's all these possible universes. And God examined all these possible universes, and he actualized the one that comes closest to what he'd like to accomplish because of this idea of middle knowledge and this idea of what men are going to do. And the result of that, I think, is an abject mess. It's very popular today, but it's an abject mess. You have a God who is a big computer in the sky, who runs all these possible universes, and he just does the best he can. And in fact, to use the words of William Lane Craig, one of the leading Molinists today, just a couple months ago, in response to a question that was sent in to him, he says, God has got to deal with the cards that have been dealt to him. So who dealt the cards? You end up with something beyond God, determining the limits of what God can do. And I don't believe in such a God. I believe that God does, according to his will in the heavens and the earth, that he is accomplishing his purposes, and that I am not autonomous. The Bible does not say I have a free will. Nowhere. Never. It says I have an enslaved will. It says that I'm dead in sin, but it nowhere says that I have a free will. And if you think it does, show me where it does, because I've never found it anywhere in the Bible.
Okay. I mean, I definitely appreciate your response. I'm going to listen to this again, and I'm genuinely interested in, like, reading more about this, like, the second half of our conversation here. Is there kind of like a specific term for what we're talking about that I could look up, or what would you recommend?
Well, there's lots of books on the subject. I mean, my main book on the subject is called The Potter's Freedom. There are.
I mean, that kind of encompasses everything. But I'm talking about, like, specifically, I guess, like Molinism, or what would you?
Yeah.
The topic of the debate.
Well, what you're talking about is the field of either God's sovereignty, God's knowledge of future events, theodicy, that is the vindication of God in regards to the existence of evil. Why did God create in such a way that there was going to be evil and things like that? On my YouTube channel, if you'll look up Molinism, M-O-L-I-N-I-S-M, you will find the presentation I did over near Biola on the subject of William Lane Craig's perspective, and then provide a biblical response to it, which I think would be relevant to what you're looking for as well.
Okay. Now, are there any of your debates that really get deep into this, or?
Well, the debate with Dr. Sanders on open theism certainly got into that, even though
I don't
hold a open theistic perspective, but obviously I was defending the idea of a sovereign decree of God that determines events and time. So I think that would be relevant at that point. That would be useful as well.
Okay, well, I definitely appreciate you taking the time, and then I'm going to listen to this again.
Okay, all right. Thanks for your call, Mike.
Yeah.
All right, God bless. All right, we went a little bit long there, but that's okay. Felt it was a good, important subject to address. And like I said, I don't know what next week is going to look like. We will try. I will make some attempt to at least do one program next week via Skype from Hawaii. I'll make the attempt. Obviously, I don't know exactly what my internet connectivity is going to be like, and scheduling and stuff like that. We'll do our best, and we'll let you know from the blog. Thanks for listening. We'll see you hopefully next week, if not the week after that. God bless.
Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again next Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. for The Dividing Line.